In association with Rogue Pictures, British Sky Broadcasting presents The Unborn, starring Odette Yussman, Gary Oldman, Megan Good, and Cam Gigandet. The writer and director is David S. Goyer, and the audio description is written and narrated by Tony Cook on behalf of the MCS Agency. Seen from above, a narrow river with leafless trees adorning the snow-covered banks on both sides. Next, the jagged skyline of a city with skyscrapers and long piers with buildings stretching over the water. Now an aerial view of a coiling pattern of road networks with cars and trucks on different levels. A figure in a tracksuit jogs across a bridge spanning a snowy wasteland. It's daytime. The elegant street lamps on the balustrade at each side are off. The jogger is a woman in her early 20s. Her sleek black hair is in a ponytail. She has an earpiece in each ear and wears a zipped-up jacket over her tracksuit. On a deserted road through woodland, she pauses and crouches forward to get her breath back. She sees a blue-knitted woolen glove lying where the road bends ahead of her. She walks in her trainers to the glove and picks it up. She slowly turns around with a puzzled look. A boy, aged about 7, is standing in the middle of the road behind her. He is wearing the other blue glove and an old-fashioned, unbuttoned jacket over his grimy white shirt. His staring greeny blue eyes have dark circles around them. She frowns curiously as he holds her gaze. The boy turns into a bull terrier-type dog that appears to be wearing the white mask of a human face. Part of a blue strap hangs from the side of the mask. The creature moves into the woodland, where patches of snow cover the ground. She follows. She sees the white mask lying on a bed of leaves. The hollow eyes stare up at her. She picks up the mask and puts down the glove. The blue strap is embedded into the ground, and she digs around with her hands as she kneels, clearing away leaves and soil. Beneath the surface, in a shallow grave, is a premature baby with a doll-like face. As she stares down anxiously, its eyes of brilliant blue flick open. Now the woman lounges on a sofa on the phone to a friend.
So what do you think the dream means?
That your vagina is completely disease-infested?
Shut up, for real.
Okay, babies. Babies are symbolic of change and renewal. If the baby is a stranger to you, it may represent something developing within yourself that is not yet ready to be born. And it doesn't say anything about babies and formaldehyde.
Okay, what about dogs?
Okay. In mythology, the dog was often seen as a messenger of the dead. And then it just goes on and on about some more cycle-bible bullshit. So, what are the kids? Did you have to, like, change diapers and shit like that?
Nope. The baby was down when I got here, and the four-year-old, he conked out as soon as I read to him.
Do you think they have porn in their DVD collection?
Like, I really want to know what Mr. Newton beats off to.
Well, it's not Mrs. Newton, that's for sure.
Okay. Hang on.
Lights flash on the baby listening monitor. She stares at the device with a puzzled frown.
Maddie, are you up? Hey, Rom, I think one of the kids is awake up. I'm gonna call you back, okay?
Good luck.
The young woman, Casey Belden, hangs up and puts down the girly magazine she was thumbing through. She stands straining to listen at the foot of the stairs in the house where she's babysitting. She stepped slowly up the stairs, holding the banister and casting a shadow on the stylish wallpaper at the other side. She sees two of the bedroom doors are open. A light is on in one of them.
Maddie?
Looking apprehensive, she steps towards the nursery where the light comes from. She sees 4-year-old Matty standing over the baby's circular cot, holding a hand mirror.
What are you doing, Matty?
She puts a hand on the boy's shoulder.
Maddie, stop that. You have to come right.
He hits Casey in the face with a mirror.
Jumbie wants to be born now.
Later.
Are you sure you're all right?
Yeah, no, it's fine. It's not a big deal.
Might feel better if you had your eye checked.
Okay,
out.
I will.
Casey looks up from the hallway and sees Maddie staring at her through the banister railings.
I'll see you guys later, okay?
As she crosses the road outside in a bobble hat with her bag over her shoulder, she spots a blue knitted glove lying in the road. She stops and stares, bewildered. Then she steps slowly towards it and picks it up to examine it. She walks the short distance home.
Hey, Dad.
Oh, hey, Case. How was sitting?
Fine.
There's cheesecake from Muscarola if you want.
No, thanks. I'm gonna crash. Good night.
In knickers and a white top, she closes the bathroom cabinet and cups her hands to have a drink of water from the tap. She dries her hands and flips her hair from her face to look through the cabinet mirror at a small mark under her left eye. She switches off the bathroom light and leaves. On hearing the tapping noise, she slowly turns. She walks back into the bathroom and switches on the light again. The noise appears to be coming from the bathroom cabinet. She opens it. She sees only shelves of toiletries. On her bedside table, there's a photograph of her as a little girl with her smiling mother, who looks a lot like Casey does now. Casey turns away from the photograph with her head on her velvet pillow. She closes her eyes with a cover pulled up to her neck. In the darkened bathroom, the mirror on the cabinet moves. It's morning. In the kitchen of the substantial detached house, Casey pours herself some orange juice and cracks a couple of eggs into a frying pan. A big insect slithers from the second egg.
Oh, God!
She tips both eggs into the sink and rinses out the frying pan. She glances out of the window and sees Matty staring up at her, later with her college friends.
He was shining a mirror in the baby's face, and then he hit me.
Okay, that's creepy.
The kid's like 4. I mean, he probably didn't even know what he was doing.
It's bad luck, you know. Newborns aren't supposed to see their own reflection until they're at least 1 year old. It means they'll die soon.
According to whom?
It's just one of those superstitions, you know.
You're retarded. She's retarded.
It's not like I'm saying I believe it. I'm just saying it's one of those things.
Okay, so as far as we know, the universe is roughly 15 billion years old, right? So if the universe had a beginning, what happened before the beginning? Einstein would tell us that there was no before, because time itself did not yet exist. So here's another question for you. How big is the universe? Does the universe just keep going on forever? And if it doesn't just keep going on, and what is beyond the end?
Casey's vision becomes blurred. She sees on the blackboard the words, Jumbi wants to be born now.
Since our universe began,
life to be born itself.
Back when you started, it'd be like walking into a mirror.
An insect walks across her hand. She springs to her feet.
Is everything all right, Casey?
Yeah, I just need to get some air.
She rushes out of the lecture theater. Her boyfriend, Mark, dashes after her. Now Casey is taking a shower. As she rinses her long hair, she leans her head on the tiles, looking troubled. She sees the face of the strange boy in her dream. She recalls seeing the white mask in the woodland. As she showers, she looks confused by it all. Next, wrapped in a towel, she's with her best friend, Romy, in the changing room.
Like the day after we went out, he put, I miss you. But then when I text him back, he never replied. And that was like 2 days ago. Chaos. There's something wrong with your eye.
What are you talking about?
I don't know, dude. I think you should look.
In a mirror, her left eye seems to be changing from hazel to blue.
It's called heterochromia, meaning one iris is a different color than the other. You know, usually it's congenital. Sometimes it occurs after blunt trauma. On very rare occasions, it might be indicative of a malignant melanoma of the iris. In order to rule that out, I'll just need to take a few digital pictures.
Okay.
I'm gonna go ahead and insert a speculum in order to keep your eyelids open.
Oh, God.
Just relax and everything will be fine.
At the optician's, she grips Mark's hand.
All right. You're doing great. Okay, go ahead and rest your chin right here. And keep your head very still while we take a few pictures, all right?
Okay.
All right. Good. Good.
Afterwards, she walks with Mark, wearing dark glasses.
So, is there...
I think the light's just a little bright because of the eye drops that he gave me. Baby. Thank you for coming with me. I know I'm such a pain in the ass right now.
Yeah.
The good news is that my dad's not going to be home till tomorrow morning.
Does that mean what I think it means?
Yes.
Great, because, you know, because those glasses, they're definitely giving me wood. Yeah, I don't know what it is.
Her smile wilts as she sees across the road the little boy in her dream staring at her. She takes off her glasses. He vanishes. Street musicians play drums behind her.
Hey, you all right?
Yeah.
That night, she and Mark sleep together.
You know, it really screws with your head. What Mr. Shields was saying, that the universe doesn't have an end. I used to have nightmares about it. And the world would just stop spinning. And we just fall off out into space. I get so upset by it. Knowing they'll just keep falling forever. And ever and ever. Huh?
Yeah. No, I mean, I still get that way when I think about time. You know, me and just all my thoughts ending.
So you don't think there's an afterlife? And why?
Because I don't feel her anywhere. But I remember the last time I saw her. We went to the hospital. And she was just sitting there, staring out the window.
In flashback, she visits her mother.
It was almost as if she was already gone.
Did she say anything to you?
Well, she was adopted, and I guess she found out who her birth mother was.
Her mother stares with her vivid blue eyes through a window where wind chimes sway.
Then she died that night. You know, they say that it takes a really long time when you hang yourself that some people have second thoughts. And then they can't do anything about it.
happier times with her mum and dad at the seaside.
God, I used to hate her for leaving us.
She lifts her head from his naked chest and they kiss. She puts on her underclothes and rinses her mouth with water in the bathroom. She dries her hands and examines her eye in the cabinet mirror. As she puts out the light and leaves the bathroom, she hears tapping noises again. She turns her shapely body and goes back to the bathroom. Looking alarmed, she whips open the bathroom cabinet. Her makeup, the toiletries, all seem to be in neat order on the shelves. With a sigh, she closes the cabinet door. She shakes her head in confusion and turns to leave. She returns to the cabinet and opens it again. She sees the face of the boy in her dream, mouth wide open with popping eyes. Mark opens it. Everything is normal.
I didn't see anything in the mirror. What did you see, huh?
Next, Casey unscrews the door mirror from the cabinet and lifts it away. She places it in the bedroom wardrobe and slides shut the doors. In the morning, she leaves her grand-looking brick house and goes on her usual jog, across the bridge with the balustrade and along the lane through the woods. She wears headphones. Next, she passes houses and sees wind chimes strung from a tree branch. She stops jogging and walks past the house where she was babysitting. A group of people have gathered outside. She talks to a woman with a dog.
Miss Burns, what's going on?
It's the baby. She wasn't breathing.
Casey looks towards the house and sees a gurney being pulled through the door by an ambulance crew. The baby's mother, Gail Newton, is distraught. Casey sees their son, Matthew, staring out from a bedroom window as Mr. Newton tries to restrain his distressed wife, the optician.
Well, we've gotten your lab results back and everything looks fine. But there was one oddity. Are you a twin by any chance, Ms. Belden?
No, I'm an only child.
Are you familiar with the term genetic mosaicism? Occasionally, when you're dealing with twins, the placentas can become fused, and a certain amount of blood will be exchanged back and forth. I suppose the emerging pigmentation in your affected iris could be the result of that foreign genetic strand. Now, I don't think it's anything you need to worry about, but you may want to see a genetic counselor just to be on the safe side.
In a skyscraper conference room overlooking the waterfront, Casey's father is interrupted by a secretary. He looks through a glass wall and sees his daughter waiting to talk to him.
Excuse me. Case, what's up?
I just got back from the eye doctor and I got my test results back.
And?
Am I a twin, Dad?
Her father looks uncomfortable.
Yes.
Oh my
you
God.
Had... You would have had a brother. Sweetheart, he died while you were still in utero.
How?
Case, it's a long time
Dad,
ago.
I need to know.
He sits Casey down.
It was a freak thing. One of the umbilical cords got twisted around his throat.
My cord?
my brother dying. Is that why Mom killed herself?
Your mother was clinically depressed. Period. The hard truth is that some people come into this world less equipped for life than others.
Like my brother?
He was never your brother, Case. It was way too early in the pregnancy for that.
Did he have a name?
Neither of you did yet. We had nicknames for you, though.
What was his nickname?
Jumbie.
Later, Casey turns on a naked light bulb in the attic and rummages through some things stored there. She opens a photo album. There are pictures of her smiling mother and Casey when she was little. She picks up a folder and unties the string securing it. She takes out two circular tins of old-fashioned cinefilm. Also in the folder, a piece of orange string worn by her mother on the wrist when she was ill in hospital. There's also a newspaper clipping with the headline, "Holocaust Survivor Remembers for Those Who Can't." It's an eyewitness account of the evil deeds that went on in the Auschwitz concentration camp during World War II. The woman quoted in the article is named as Sophie Cosmer. Casey finds a black and white photograph of her pregnant mother standing next to a mirror. The mirror also reflects the image of a boy who resembles the boy in Casey's dream. She picks up a magnifying glass to get a clearer view. Next, a large five-story nursing home set in its own grounds, which are covered with a blanket of snow.
I can't believe I let you talk me into coming down here.
Look, my mom obviously thought this woman was important. I mean, why would she have kept that article and this creepy photo?
The kid from your dream?
Yes.
Okay. You know, Case, if this was me, I would just take one of my mom's Xanax and I would just call it a day.
Okay, so just wait in the car.
Oh, no, no. This is way too bizarro for me to miss out on.
Excuse me? We're here to see Sophie Cosma. We called earlier.
Yeah, if you could please sign in.
He is on the third floor, room 307.
As Casey climbs the staircase, her black friend Romy helps herself to sweets from a bowl on the reception desk before following. Elderly people mill around, some in wheelchairs, others with sticks.
God, it smells like diarrhea there. Look at the Munchkin lady.
In a corridor, an elderly man with vacant eyes sits slumped in a wheelchair.
The guy's wearing a diaper. God, I never want to get old.
No one does. Mr. Walker suffered a stroke. Now he's paralyzed from the waist down. But he doesn't suffer much anymore. His mind is elsewhere.
They step into Sophie's room. Wind chimes hang in the window.
It's very homey here.
It's tolerable. I've certainly endured worse.
What was over there?
Oh, there used to be a mirror there. I had it removed. Are you a twin, Casey?
I was. I had a brother who died in the womb. How did you know that?
I used to have a twin brother as well. I can sense it sometimes in others, certain kind of manner.
I just recently found out about my brother, and that's sort of what led me here today. My mother's name was Janet Belden. She passed away a few years ago, but I found this in her things.
The newspaper clipping. White-haired Sophie wears a piece of orange string on her wrist close to where a number is tattooed. She grips a medallion shaped like the Star of David.
Did you know my mother?
No, I'm afraid not.
She never tried to contact you?
The old woman shakes her head.
Well, this is her. Are you sure you've never seen her?
I'm sorry, dear.
What about the boy in the reflection here? Did you know him?
Get out! Get out!
I'm sorry, what did I...
Get out!
What the hell was that? 1 second she's fine, and then she does a bitch flip.
How did she know I was a twin?
She's crazy. She probably has Alzheimer's.
No. No, she knew something.
Come on, get real.
What if she does?
She doesn't!
Look, you had some weird dreams, and then this thing happens with your eye, and then you found out that you would have had a brother, and believe me, that alone is enough to send me into therapy. But that's all we're talking about here. Just some weird coincidences, yes.
No, what about the Newtons' baby dying?
What about the Newtons' baby?
And what Maddie said?
He said Jumbie, Romy. The nickname that my parents used for my brother. You're the superstitious one here. You tell me there's not something really going on because you know there is. I'm not crazy, Romy. But ever since Maddie freaked out that night, I've been seeing things.
What kinds of things?
Do you believe in ghosts?
You know I do.
Do you think it's possible to be haunted by someone who was never even born?
Back at her home, Mark assembles a cine projector.
You owe me. These things are not easy to find these days. You sure you want to see what Tom is?
He plays the film she found in the attic. Casey grips Mark's arm as scratchy black and white images appear. The outside of an austere grey stone building with a clock tower. A heavy entrance door set in an archway at the top of some steps. The word administration is inscribed on the glass at the top of the entrance. Inside the building there's a stark corridor with a light that hangs on a long flex from the ceiling. With a troubled look, Casey gets to her feet and walks closer to the wall where the picture is projected. There's a shot of a high-ceilinged room with two heavy chairs, and then a corridor with statues set on plinths in the wall. Casey turns away and glances back at Mark as the camera focuses on a closed door. It zooms in on a brass plate where the doorknob is inset. Casey's eyes sink to the floor with a reflective look as Mark switches off.
Did it mean anything to you?
It was the hospital where my mom died. Beyond that door. That's where she hung herself.
A metro train.
She left all that stuff for a reason. You know, like she was, I don't know, trying to tell me something. Oh my God, you think I'm crazy, don't you?
No, I don't think you're crazy. A little hormonal maybe, but you're not crazy. Let's try to have some fun.
Okay.
Ben?
Yes.
A nightclub. Romy and another girl join them inside.
Hey kids, are we faded yet?
We're trying. But I'm gonna go to the bar if you girls want anything.
I will have a vodka and Red Bull.
Me too.
No.
Mark kisses Casey.
Oh, why can't I meet a nice guy like that? Please, I said you look like Craig Finch and you totally blew him off. You wouldn't even talk to him.
Casey touches her head, looking disorientated. Her vision is becoming blurred. All around her, faces look distorted. Her mouth falls open in shock when across the dance floor, she sees a young boy staring at her. It's the boy from her dream, in the old-fashioned clothing. The dancers seem unaware of him. He holds Casey's gaze with his popping blue eyes and snarls viciously at her. Casey rinses her face in the washroom. In her low-cut blue dress, she leans into the mirror, swaying to and fro with a droplet of water on her chin. Her left eye is now distinctly blue. Next, she's being sick in the lavatory. With sweat glistening on her forehead, she sits on the tiled floor of the cubicle. She glances down and sees, through the partition gap, some toilet paper on the floor of the next cubicle. She strains to hear something. There's a hole in the partition wall, with an eye drawn around it, with the words, "In the kingdom of the blind, the one-eyed man is king." As she stares, tentacles lunge at her through the hole. She wriggles back as a browny orange liquid with swarming insects floods into the cubicle. She dashes from the cubicle and pulls on the washroom door, but it won't open. The gooey liquid is now pouring from the wash basins as well. The insects are swarming everywhere. Bricks in the wall are dislodged, and more tentacles burst through. The door of a cubicle opens. She sees bare feet, and then the figure of a dark-haired woman in a blue dress. It's her dead mother.
Case, hey, what happened?
Are you okay?
Huh? As Mark and Romy burst in, everything is back to normal. Casey cowers on the floor. Later, lying on her bed, Casey talks to Romy via her laptop.
Hey, girlie, you okay?
I saw her.
Who?
My mother.
You were drinking. You were buzzed. It was just hallucination.
This was different. She was there. What if the same thing that happened to my mother is happening to me? What if I end up like she did?
Have you talked to your dad about it?
He's out of town.
Casey, you are not going to end up like her, okay?
How do you know? You can't have it both ways, Romy. Either I'm actually crazy, or something's coming after me, and if that's the case, then I have to protect myself.
Okay. Put a pair of scissors underneath your pillow with the two points open.
Why?
Something my grandmother used to do. She said it keeps evil spirits away.
You're a freak, Romy.
Yes, but isn't that why you love me?
Yeah, I guess so. Good night.
Good night, hooker.
Casey shuts down her webcam and closes her laptop. She gets from the bed and goes to a drawer. She removes a pair of scissors and partially opens them before placing them under her pillow. She gets back into bed and ponders with a faraway look before switching off the bedside light. Later in the night, she has an out-of-body experience. She is suspended against the wall of the bedroom, looking down at her sleeping self in bed. She shakes her head, looking alarmed, as she watches the bed covers slide back. The boy she dreamt about is in the bed. His hand pushes up her top before resting on her stomach. The suspended Casey tries desperately to reach out to stop him. He throws her a glance with his evil blue eyes. The other self remains asleep as the boy thrusts his hand through her skin and right into her abdomen. Her mobile phone wakes her up. It's been a dream. Trying to regain her composure, she reaches for her phone.
Hello.
I need to speak with you.
Sophie.
I'm sorry for what happened before, but there are things you need to know. You must come.
It's after midnight.
This can't wait. I lied about knowing your mother. She did come to see me just before she died.
Oh my God. You're the woman she was talking about. You're her mother.
Yes.
Casey meets Sophie in the spacious library at the nursing home.
Why did you lie to me earlier?
I'm sorry. I was just so startled. Your mother never told me you were a twin. But when I saw your eyes today, I knew. The boy in the reflection? That was your great uncle. My twin brother, Bartow. He died in 1944, when we were together in Auschwitz.
Casey studies a photo of Sophie and her twin, Bartow.
We were taken to see the doctor in charge, a man who was obsessed with twins.
In flashback, she and Barto are led through a crowded hut towards a uniformed Nazi.
He was very handsome, very polite. We thought we'd been rescued.
He offers them each a sweet from his gloved hand. Next, they lie together on a board. A tube is attached to little Sophie's arm.
The Nazis believed that twins could unravel the mysteries of genetics.
Doctors in white coats are with Sophie, her brother, and other twins.
They conducted experiments on us. Horrible experiments that blurred the line between science and the occult. One of their obsessions was eye color. By trial and error, they attempted to fabricate blue eyes from brown.
A doctor points a needle at a boy's eye.
The injections were painful. Some caused blindness. Some caused death.
A white sheet is placed over Barto's body. His shoes are dumped on a pile of others. Later, the boy sits up and removes the sheet. He stares straight ahead, grim-faced, with vivid blue eyes.
Two days later, he came back. Except, it wasn't really Barto. A doorway had been opened. Something else was inhabiting his body.
Something else.
Have you ever heard of a Dybbuk?
Mm-mm.
It is the soul of a dead person that has been barred from entering heaven. So it endlessly wanders the borderlands between the worlds, trying to find a new body.
Some people are doorways.
Yes, especially twins. Because what is a twin but another kind of mirror? And mirrors have always been doorways to the other world.
A flashback to the bathroom cabinet and then Matty holding a mirror over the cot.
What happened to your brother?
From the moment he came back, I knew it wasn't Barto. A Dybbuk had crossed over. Place. It had used his body to enter our world. I killed it. It's been trying to find its way back ever since. Casey, the Dybbuk's blood is on our hands now. This thing, this entity, had tried to take hold of the unborn twin. And when it couldn't have him, it turned its gaze to the other child.
Me.
Sophie nods.
It's been circling you ever since you were born, Casey.
Casey recalls the rest of the conversation as she waits at a station and then rides on a train.
Why now? Why didn't this start happening before?
It takes time for it to make its way from the other side. And when it arrives here, it's weak.
Well, how do I stop it?
Your mother asked the same question. I told her about the Sefer HaMarot, the Book of Mirrors, which includes the rites of exorcisms. There is a rabbi who may be able to help you. Joseph Sandak. Find him.
Casey sits in a deserted carriage on the metro train as it pulls into the night. Next, in a vast public library, she browses through a book. She sits at the library computer making notes about Jewish folklore. In the religion and mysticism section, the computer pinpoints the Book of Mirrors by an unknown author. It tells her the text is in Hebrew Spanish. In the reference section, an assistant brings her the ancient thick book.
Exercise care when handling the manuscript.
Thank you.
She opens the book and sees unfamiliar writing. There are diagrams and sketches of demons and hobgoblin-type creatures. She looks away from the pages and steals a glance at a uniformed security man. When he leaves, she gets to her feet and steals the book. Across the city, Casey tracks down the rabbi Sophie recommended. He's winding up a meeting of some sort of self-help group.
It's mostly no man. Each day is a struggle, you know? I keep trying to do that searching thing. Make moral inventory of myself. Be fearless.
Well, that's all we can ask. Thank you for sharing, Rick. All right, it looks like we're about finished for the day. We'll pick up where we left off next week. Cool. If I'm not mistaken, Henry's up to bat on donut duty. Go easy on us, will you, Henry? Right. Throw in a few low-fat muffins.
Excuse me? Are you Rabbi Sendak?
Yes.
Can you read this?
She hands the book across his desk. He unclasps it and opens the pages.
Well, the right-hand text is Hebrew, so I can. It's from the Kabbalah. Jewish mysticism. How did you come by this?
Look, I know that this is going to sound crazy. Leave me. But I need an exorcism performed. I'm being haunted by something. A dibbuk. Yes.
Well, as for dibbuks, there really is no such thing, Miss Balda. At least not outside the realms of folklore. You have to understand, back in the Middle Ages, things like spirits and demons were really just a catch-all for conditions people weren't capable of properly diagnosing. Mental illness, as we know it, didn't exist back then.
I'm not mentally ill. Okay, what's happening to me is real.
Even assuming it is, what you're asking is beyond my expertise. I've never performed an exorcism before. I wouldn't even know where to begin.
Well, you could read the book. I mean, it would tell you what to do.
And then what? For a religious ceremony to be effective, the person asking for help has to actually believe in the spiritual aid they're calling upon. And I'm guessing you don't believe.
Casey looks close to tears. He stares kindly at her over his specs.
Look, maybe I could do a little research. I can make some calls.
Okay.
What about your book?
Can you translate it for me? Listen, my life depends on this. So please help.
As the snow starts to fall, Casey walks home in deep thought. She recalls more of her meeting with Sophie.
Take this. It is the hand of Miriam. It may offer some protection.
The star medallion.
Stay away from mirrors. If you have any in your home, you must destroy them.
Back home, Casey smashes mirrors with a crowbar.
Burn the pieces of broken mirror, and then bury what remains.
She burns and buries the glass fragments.
Bells, wind chimes. These are signs that the spirit is near.
She hangs chimes at her window.
You must be vigilant, Casey. It will seek to isolate you, to weaken your resolve.
She views the cine film again.
Can it be killed?
It's already dead. The best you can hope for is to drive it back again. There's no use in trying to understand it, Casey. It's not human anymore. It is an outsider now. It is no longer of this universe.
This time she sees a bull terrier type dog that snarls at the camera. She stares transfixed at the new images. An eerie white hand reaches out to the closed door, guarding the room where her mother hanged herself. Casey reels back in shock. Listening to music, Romy drives her silver Toyota towards Casey's house. Suddenly, she comes upon 4-year-old Matty, who is riding a tricycle in the road. He pulls in front of her, and she hits him, knocking him from his bike. He bounces off her bonnet into the road. She gets out and sees him standing at the rear of the car, apparently uninjured. She squats down to him.
Oh my God, sweetie, are you okay?
He doesn't want you to help her. If you try to help her, he'll kill you.
Fuck off, little shit.
He stares at her precociously as she gets back into her car. She glances in her rear mirror and sees him staring after her.
Oh my God, Casey, I hit that kid from across the street with my car, but then he was okay, and I don't know. Something was seriously wrong with that kid. Case, your eyes are getting worse. I know.
Romy steps into Casey's house. Both of Casey's eyes are now blue.
Case, dude, what's going on? You haven't been to class. You're not returning my phone calls. What happened to the mirror?
I broke it.
Why?
Because Sophie told me to.
Is that hag from the old people's home?
She's my grandmother, Romy. She told me the truth about everything.
My God.
It's real. Everything that has been happening is real. It's some kind of ghost or demon or something. And it tried to take over my brother. And that's why my mother went crazy. She knew that it would eventually come after me. It wants to be reborn into this world. Listen to me right now. You have to stay away from me. It is not safe to be around me anymore.
No. No, no. I am your best friend. And I am not gonna just abandon you.
Romy gives her a hug. Behind them both, the mirror over the mantelpiece is smashed. The snow-covered branches of trees form delicate patterns and morph into an aerial view of the large house surrounded by virgin snow, where Casey is now alone again. She goes to bed while it's still light. Soon she is asleep and has another nightmare. She is inside the now deserted and derelict hospital where her mother died. The light from the large windows casts shadows inside the building. The door to her mother's room is flanked by 2 stone statues, one of them headless. In slow motion, she opens the door and steps inside. Casey's eyes shine with a vivid blueness, even inside the darkened room of shadows. She steps towards a figure sitting in a chair, dressed in blue with her head held low. The figure has her back to Casey, but appears to be her mother. Casey steps to the front of the figure, who is gripping something in a large bottle and gently rocking to and fro. Wearing the star-shaped medallion Sophie gave her, Casey kneels down. The figure raises its head. The teeth protrude. The flesh has been eaten away. The bottle smashes onto the floor, disgorging a fetus and brown liquid. Now awake, Casey stares at her bedroom window, the wind chime she hung there a-swaying. She looks out and sees the boy in her dream, standing in the snow, staring up at her. In the nursing home, Sophie sits up in bed, and she too stares at the window, her wind chimes a-swaying.
I am thankful to you, Eternal King, who has mercifully returned my soul within me. Your faithfulness is great, amen.
Sophie leans over to switch on her bedside light. The light won't switch on. With a walking stick and a torch, she limps from the bedroom. She tries a switch on the landing, but still no light. She walks slowly along a shadowy corridor and turns when she thinks she hears something. Using the torch to guide her, she retraces her steps and goes into a room off the corridor.
Eli?
Her torch beam picks out Eli, sitting in his wheelchair with his head to one side and his eyes vacant. Sophie plods down the stairs. She shines her torch around.
Eli?
The torch beam picks out an overturned wheelchair with a wheel still spinning. As she heads down another flight of stairs, she sees Eli crawling up the stairs towards her.
Eli!
His scrawny head clicks round until it's upside down on his neck. His mouth opens, and he looks pretty scary as he bounds up the stairs towards her like a demented dog. He chases her on all fours along a shiny corridor. She slips through another door and then falls down a flight of stairs. The door above is being forced. She hauls herself up, gripping the banister. She exits through another door marked maintenance. She sees the shadow of Eli crawling down the stairs after her. She whips shut the door. In the light under the door, there are moving shadows. Looking terrified, she tries to compose herself. Then she turns and sees the snarling face of her possessed twin brother, Barto. The next day, a police car with its lights flashing is parked outside the nursing home as Casey and Romy approach, both looking apprehensive. They walk up the steps to the reception area. Eli, now back in his wheelchair, throws Casey a hard stare. She returns his gaze, looking unsettled. Casey is escorted through a police barrier into a corridor. Casey is led to the maintenance room, where a man is examining the body of Sophie, which lies on the floor with the torch nearby. Casey backs out of the room, looking devastated. Casey and Romy march away from the home. A woman chases after them, holding an envelope.
Miss Belden! Miss Belden! Sophie wanted you to have this, in case anything happened.
Thank you!
In tears, Casey takes a letter from the envelope.
Dear Casey, it has fallen upon you to finish what began in Auschwitz. Be careful.
The Dybbuk feeds on fear. It has a taste for our family's blood now, and it won't rest until it's had its revenge. I tried to stop it, and your mother did as well, but she lost the battle. She gave in to her fear. Whatever happens, don't let it turn you against yourself. It will seek to isolate you by attacking your friends, your family. But it is you that it most desires.
In his study at the synagogue, the rabbi is translating the book Casey stole from the public library. He works his way through the Hebrew print and the sketches. One shows a demon dog with his head twisted upside down on its neck. His desk light goes out. He gets to his feet and flicks the main light switch on the wall. With the light still out, he peers through the window blinds at the rain pouring down outside. Wearing a blue shirt, he steps onto a gantry with a flashlight and shines it down. Then he descends a spiral staircase holding the flashlight. That goes out too. He shakes and wallops the light, but it won't come back on. He goes through a door into the auditorium. On a stage ahead of him, pieces of paper are fluttering about in the air. The paper litters the stage. Then a dog appears. It's a bull terrier type, with its head on upside down. It eyes him up and snarls. Rabbi glances around, looking frightened. The paper is no longer fluttering, and the dog has vanished. Casey and Romy are having a web chat.
Maybe it's not even really after you.
It killed my mother.
You don't know that.
Yes, I do. And now it's killed Sophie, too. It's
gonna take everybody that I love away from me. That's what it does. It's gonna wear me down, and then when I don't have any strength left to fight it, that's when it's gonna come for me. I don't know. Maybe you should leave town.
No, no, it wouldn't help.
It's gonna follow me wherever I go. It's gonna kill me, Romy. Hold on for a second, dude. Someone's at my door. No, don't answer that!
On her laptop, Casey sees Romy get from her bed and go to answer the door. Casey does a double take as she sees on her screen a reflection in Romy's bedroom mirror. It's the boy again. She grabs her mobile phone.
Casey?
Mark, meet me at Romy's house. Something's wrong.
What are you...
Do it! Go!
Romy cautiously steps down the stairs to the hallway. She pauses when the house lights go out, but then continues on towards the main door. She tries a light switch, but to no avail. She peers through the upper windows on the door, but all she can see is the pouring rain. She opens the door. Matty is standing outside in a hooded waterproof.
The doorway is open.
What?
The boy thrusts a knife into her stomach. Romy sinks to the floor. Then she tries to crawl up the stairs as Matty enters the house. It's pouring with rain as Mark pulls up outside. Casey is already at the front door.
What?
Romy crawls along the landing.
I told you not to help her.
As Matty raises the knife, Mark crashes through the glass in the French windows.
Let's go.
Mark and Casey race upstairs. Mark wrestles with Matty, whose face is now hideously distorted.
No! Mark, stop! Stop!
It's not in him anymore.
Matty cowers, looking normal again, but the evil has entered Romy. Her eyes have turned blue. Her body is writhing. Her face is contorted. Later, as the rain still pours down, Casey and Mark are outside with police and ambulance crews. Matty sits in the back of an ambulance. His parents comfort him. Later still, Mark and Casey have a coffee in a diner.
It's my fault. It killed her because of me.
Where'd it come from?
I don't know. It's not like us. I don't even think that it comes from the same universe.
But you can sense when it's near.
Yes. It's getting stronger, Mark. And I can feel it everywhere. And I think that it's strong enough to enter anyone now. Even the dead.
They look up as a weird-looking guy in a bobble hat comes in and takes a seat. He moves jerkily.
So no place is safe?
No. No, see, I don't think that the world was ever safe. I think that we were always just trying to pretend like it was, but it's not.
Outside, the rain cascades down. Through the diner window, the weird guy is seen rocking to and fro in his seat. Next, a view from above of the city, and then at a basketball practice, Casey and Mark sit with the rabbi.
That's good. That's what I need to see.
Why did you change your mind?
Now, I can't say I truly believe in what's afflicting you, but I think you believe. And if you're convinced an exorcism is what you need, then who am I to turn you away?
If you'd seen what I saw last night, you wouldn't have any problem believing.
So why are we meeting here?
Because we need backup. I may be a man of God, but I'm not a miracle worker.
The black basketball coach, who has a beard, greets the rabbi and they hug.
This is Casey.
Hey, nice to meet you.
Mark. And this is Arthur Wyndham. He is an Episcopal priest and a very, very dear friend of mine.
So you've done exorcisms?
No, I studied the phenomenon. I did my dissertation in it back in college.
Well, just wait a second. I'm not looking for a Christian exorcism here.
No, fair enough. But there are certain elements of these kind of rites that are pretty common to virtually all religions, and it's these elements that I'm familiar with. You gotta understand, this thing that's after you, if it exists, it predates religion, probably predates mankind. It's not as if there's one kind of demon that is vulnerable to Jewish prayer and another that is allergic to Christian or Muslim. It doesn't actually work that way.
So the words in that book, they can't help people?
No. On the contrary, I think that it can, but not in a way that you might think. Now, you may not believe, but your mother and your grandmother did, and it's because of their belief that these words give us the best shot at driving this thing out.
I've translated what's in the book, so I'll be leading the invocation, and Arthur and a few others will be assisting us.
All right. So when do we do it?
Tomorrow night, Sabbath.
At your synagogue?
Oh, no. Given how unorthodox this all is, I think we'll find another venue.
Yeah. Is there somewhere that is particularly negative to you? Somewhere that you may have incurred a lot of pain?
The next night, Casey leads the exorcism team to the derelict hospital where her mother died. The stone clock tower looms up to a black sky. They go inside with their torches and equipment. Shafts of moonlight through stained glass windows illuminate a spacious hall. The tiled floor is littered with debris. Graffiti is on the walls. Casey stares along a wide corridor that she saw on the cine film. A torch picks out a ghostly face painted on a screen with holes for the eyes and mouth.
That was the place to get religious, Sinday.
Cheery, isn't it?
This is Rick Hess. He's an EMT. I thought it would be a good idea to have him here just in case.
Nice to meet you.
And as for the other volunteers, well, they've all been through some kind of hardship and are willing to help. Now, typically, a Jewish exorcism writing board is 10 people.
Why 10?
10 fingers, 10 commandments. 10 is also the number of the Spirit, which are the known attributes of God. The idea is that these 10 form a protective circle around the afflicted person.
Yeah, once we get going, Casey will stand in the middle of the circle. Sandak will read the original text in Hebrew, and the rest of you will follow me in English, call and response format.
Now, the heart of the ceremony is Psalm 91. Yoshev Beseter, the psalm of protection. At the beginning and the end of the invocation, I'll sound the shofar, which is an animal horn used in religious ceremonies. In this case, the sound is intended to shock the spirit hiding within the victim. Once the spirit is more compliant, then we can start drawing it out.
That's when the rest of us are the most vulnerable. It wants Casey, but it would take any port in the storm. And remember, no matter what happens, once we've begun, the exorcism must be finished. Any questions?
Yeah, why are they bringing in a gurney?
The gurney is for Casey's protection, as well as ours. Sometimes people thrash out, just a precaution. That's all.
All right, then. Let's get started.
An arc light is switched on. So too is a lantern which rests on a table next to the animal horn and the ancient book that the rabbi has translated. Casey settles herself down on the gurney. She wears the medallion star Sophie gave her.
Are you sure you won't go through with this?
I just want this to be over.
My name is Arthur Windham, and this is the video record of the attempted exorcism of Casey Belden. We have the permission of the ecclesiastical authority who are praying for us. Everyone participating tonight is here of their own free will, including Casey.
Agreed?
Yes.
Just for the camera.
Yes, this is what I want.
No, if, and this is a big if, but assuming the spirit actually manifests itself on your person, it may take the shape of a kind of bulge beneath the flesh. Now, try not to be alarmed by this. Even though we're dealing with a spiritual phenomenon, the entity still needs to be housed in some degree of physical mass. So if your body produces a reaction like that, it means what we're doing is working.
I understand.
All right.
Okay, so we're gonna place this block in your mouth so you don't bite on your tongue.
Let's just get on with this.
Okay.
The block is placed in Casey's mouth and secured by a band around her head. She lies with her wrists strapped to the gurney, and the team form a circle around her. The rabbi picks up the animal horn.
The circle is now made whole and sacred.
Hashem Adonai Elohei Israel, Mimini Michael, Umismali Gabriel, Umilfana Uriel, Omeachorai Raphael.
In the name of Adonai, God of Israel, may Michael be by my right, Gabriel by my left, Uriel before me, Raphael behind me, beneath my feet, ground of God.
Omar Ladonai Maxi Sodati, Elohai Eftachbo, Kihu Yatsil Hach Mipak Yakosh Miteve Chavot.
I say to you of the Lord, who is my refuge and my stronghold, my God in whom I trust, that he will save you from the foul snare and destructive pestilence.
Beabrato Yasaklach, Vatachat Kenavab.
He will cover you with his feathers, and you will find refuge in his wings.
Casey sees an insect crawling on a rail. A door bursts open, the long hanging ceiling lights start to sway.
Keep going! Stop breathing!
Oh,
Visions flood Casey's head, the dog with a white mask, the door behind which her mother hanged herself. Her body writhes on the gurney. She sees the image of the young boy, Barto, on a balcony. The door to her mother's room slowly opens.
The doorway is open.
The arc lights flicker and surge. A wind blows through the room. Arthur, wearing his clerical collar, clasps his hands together in desperate prayer. Casey stares at the image of Barto standing next to her. Now she pictures herself entering the room where her mother died. But she is still strapped to the gurney. Her face becomes grotesque. Her chest appears to open up, revealing her organs. An energy force sends people reeling to the floor. A woman volunteer is having violent convulsions. A blood-colored fetus smashes out of a jar and is left splashing in liquid on the floor. Casey is twisting and squirming. Mark struggles to unstrap her from the gurney. Arthur goes down to his knees, still praying. The wind rips pages from the ancient book the rabbi is reading from. The boy in the image of Barto stares unflinchingly at Casey with his vivid blue eyes. The rabbi is swept off his feet and lands in a tangle of overturned arc lights. Casey is released from the gurney and whisked away by Mark. The gurney hurtles through the air, crashing into a volunteer. Casey dashes back to pick up one of the translation pages. Arthur the priest is still on his knees. He blesses himself. The boy, with his eyes popping, stares directly at Arthur, who timidly holds his gaze. Arthur's eyes turn blue. He lets out a manic roar. Mark and Casey run for all they're worth along a corridor. Arthur chases after them like a man possessed. Mark and Casey continue running through the building, passing a bed on wheels left behind from the hospital days. Mark grabs her wrist and leads her into another room. She slams shut the door and they sink down beneath a smashed window with their backs against a wall. Both look scared. With sweat glistening on her face, Casey grips Mark with both hands. A pair of hands smash through the wall behind Mark. They grip him and pull him through. The hands belong to Arthur, who attacks Mark with superhuman strength, tossing him about the room. Casey jumps on Arthur, but is flung back with a manic glint in his eyes. The priest pounds his fists into Mark's face. Casey tries once more to drag him off Mark, and he goes for her instead. Mark picks up a crowbar and hits Arthur on the head with it. Arthur is knocked out and Mark slumps down. Casey crawls over to Mark and rests her head wearily on his shoulder.
Baby, we gotta go. Get up, baby. Come on. Baby, you're hurting me. Mark, stop it!
Now Mark is possessed. Casey races away. He's trying to fight the evilness and bangs his head against the wall in a frenzy. Casey reaches another room in the vast hospital building and glances all around with her vivid blue eyes, looking for a place to hide. She turns round to find Mark right behind her. He lifts her up and pins her against a wall with his hands round her throat. An insect with tentacles looms out from his mouth. She grips the star medallion she's wearing and jabs it into his neck. He releases her and plucks it out. The rabbi appears.
No evil will befall you, no plague will come near thy dwelling. For he will command his angels in your behalf to guide you in all your ways, that you will lift the stone, you will tread on the lion and the cobra, and you will trample the great lion and the dragon, because he loves me, says the Lord. Call upon him, and I will be with him in trouble, and I will
lurches backwards and topples over a balcony railing. Casey is overcome with grief as she sees his body lying in the main hall where the exorcism started. The rabbi puts his arm round her shoulder. She rushes down to where Mark lies, and he comes round, the evil having left him. She cups his blood-stained head in her hands.
Casey.
Yeah?
Did you stop him?
I think so.
Hey. Am I gonna keep falling forever?
Her eyes brim with tears as he passes out again. She rests his head down and nuzzles her face close to his. Time passes. Casey is jogging over the bridge with balustrade and elegant lamps, a bridge flanked with fields of snow. Images come into her mind.
Why now? Why didn't this start happening before?
She's working out dates on a calculator. She's making love with Mark.
A little hormonal maybe, but you're not crazy.
She remembers being sick in the lavatory. She's reading a pregnancy tester and ponders deeply. She lies on a bed as a doctor scans her stomach.
And it looks like double congratulations are in order. You're carrying twins.
Jumbie wants to be born now.
She looks at a monitor showing two babies developing inside her. The end.